Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
You know, the election in November is huge and everyone's focused on it, but as soon as it's over, you better believe we're going to start hearing from a parade of Democratic candidates running for president in 2020. So no rest for the weary voter, particularly in places like Iowa and New Hampshire. And one person who's visited both those places recently is Steve Bullock, the two-term governor of Montana, a Democratic governor of a state that Donald Trump carried by 20 points, a western state, not a coastal state. And that has people asking, could he have the special secret sauce that can help Democrats win back some of the voters that they lost in 2016? Governor Bullock came by the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago last week, where I sat down with him to ask him about his life, his career, and his plan. Governor Steve Bullock, great to be with you.
Sure, great to be with you too, Dave.
Here on the campus of the University of Chicago, just spoke to a mob of kids, of young people. I shouldn't call them kids because they're not, of young people from the Institute of Politics, around the Institute of Politics. So happy to have you there. Let me talk about you as a kid. From Missoula, but really from Helena, Montana. How long ago did your family come to Montana? How'd they get there?
So my parents met at a college in Colorado. At the time, it was Colorado State Teachers College. And my father's first job was in Missoula, so that took us.
So they weren't Montanans.
They were not. My mother was raised in Wyoming, principally, and my dad had kind of moved around quite a bit. But yeah, their first trip was post-college when they moved to Montana.
And you grew up in Helena, as I mentioned. Delivered newspapers to the governor's mansion.
Yeah, I had.
It's a little different in Montana than it is in some other states. You can't just walk up to the governor's mansion and drop a newspaper on the.
Well, you still pretty much can in Montana, and yeah, I grew up four blocks.
You guys still have newspapers there, right? A lot of places don't.
I still read my Helen Independent Record first thing every morning with a cup of coffee, but yeah, grew up about four blocks from where I'm raising my family now, and raised in a single parent household. But one of the summer jobs.
When did your folks split?
My parents divorced in about fifth grade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you have brothers and sisters?
I have one older brother. He's 3 years older than I. So It was he and I's paper route. So we delivered sort of both to the governor's house and all over the Capitol complex.
And your folks were educators.
Yeah. Yeah, my father had worked first as a distributive education, a DECA teacher, and then worked at the alternative school. My mother had an education degree, had taught kindergarten when they were still together, but had taken time off. And then when my parents divorced, and she had to find herself back into the world of work.
Was it difficult for you, them splitting up?
You know, it's. I think today it's almost not that unique, but in the late 70s, to be in a single parent household headed by a woman, like, that wasn't my friends. So it was substantially different in that respect. And it wasn't. There were just the economic struggles that any single parent head of household has and still has today.
One of your friends growing up was Griff Williams, the son of Pat Williams, the longtime congressman from Montana. You only have one. And how did this politics bug bite you? Was it early as back then?
Well, it's funny because I often say my first door-to-door experience was, Pat Williams' first campaign in 1978. And his theme was door-to-door for Congress, Pat Williams for Congress. And Carol Williams, who ended up a force in her own right, she was a minority leader of our state Senate, but Pat's wife, made Griff and I peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So that sort of got me on the road.
That was all it took to get you to go door-to-door.
Huh? Yeah, that got me door-to-door and engaged, but got a little bit engaged more in sort of both the student government and was on the State Board of Public Education as a student representative at the same time that, Reagan's Nation at Risk came out. So got involved in sort of the education side of that, but sort of real politics or in the political system, not until a bit later.
And you went to college in California?
Yeah, I ended up, I was looking mostly at University of Montana. That's where all my friends were going. My mother did research and was trying to figure out where it would be good. So she found a small college outside of Los Angeles called Claremont McKenna.
Yeah, sure.
And I went sight unseen.
Why did she think that would be good for you?
I think maybe just I did okay in high school, but I never took academics that seriously. I was more interested in the activities outside of school. So maybe just also to get me out to see more of the world. She found that place, and so I ended up applying to two schools, University of Montana and Claremont McKenna College.
So that must have been a culture shock, moving from Helena, Montana to just outside of Los Angeles.
In so many ways. I mean, I'll never forget, showing up that first day and all of the swim pools were outside. I think I'd been at that point in my life probably been on a plane three or four times. And it was a culture shock in as much as that I'd met, first time ever meeting kids that had gone to, prep schools and had every advantage in the world. It took me about probably 6-7 months, maybe not even that long, to recognize what incredible public education I received and what I was given to build off of in Montana could make me academically as good as anybody else.
And what did you study? What was your interest?
So there was it was an interdisciplinary major called politics, philosophy, and economics. So, and the professors all worked together. There was only about 12 of us in it. So it was a liberal arts major. And what we would do is, like, you'd write a paper. You'd have one of the teachers is based on sort of a tutorial. One of your other students would critique your ideas and rip it apart just in front of the professor. And all three of the facets of it were sort of all interrelated. So when you're learning about philosophy, you're also learning about political philosophy and economic philosophy.
Having your classmates rip your paper apart must have been good preparation for politics.
It was great. It was great because also at the time – and they've gone quite a ways, but CMC was viewed as very – actually, like, there, a lot of the political science faculty was out of the Reagan administration. My thesis reader, who's still a good friend, a guy named Jack Pitney, worked for the National Republican Committee. So I had to figure out what my values and perspective was, and I had to defend it, but also in a way that – was respectful, and that so it really helped me along the way. And that it's I'm over 30 years out of college, but still keep in touch with both professors and others from there. So it was a great experience for me.
And you took a break after college. Tell you spent 3 years kind of bumming around. Well, what were you doing?
Yeah, for some reason I decided in grade school that I wanted to be a lawyer. I don't think I knew any lawyers. But I had this vision that a lawyer could not only do good and impact people's lives, but probably make a little bit better living than anything that I ever knew. So I decided from grade school I wanted to be a lawyer. And was prepping. I took the LSAT, like all these practices. And come test day, I mean, I failed the LSAT miserably. I still have my bubble theory that I wrote it all one off, but I don't think I was qualified to watch Law and Order the way that I failed it. So all my plans in life, I'm going to go to college, I'm going to go to law school, got put on hold. So I decided to work for a couple years. First, I interviewed in New York. That was way too much for me. I wanted to go east, get out of Southern California. Ended up at a sort of investment slash.
Why was New York too much for you?
You know, for a guy from Montana, and then had spent time in California, I actually did talk to some folks at Chicago, but it was just probably too intense. I just didn't think that, subsequently lived in New York, but didn't think that that would be the place for me. But Philadelphia in the late 80s, where I ended up working, was blue-collar friendly. Mm-hmm. You know, you'd meet your neighbors. You could go out. There weren't concerns. So that's where I ended up for 2 years, working at sort of an investment firm.
And then you ended up at Columbia Law School.
Yeah, I ended up I took
pretty good law school.
It worked out okay. Yeah. Yeah, I ended up taking, after that time in Pennsylvania, I was back in Montana for a little bit, but then went to Columbia.
And you gravitated toward state and local government law, and you had mentors there that were?
Yeah, yeah, like Professor Brafal and others, though I kind of worked my way through college and borrowed my way through law school. I mean, I came out of law school with $100,000+ of debt and had this great idea I was going to work – pay off those loans, then decide what I wanted to do and be when I grew up. But while I was there, my father got stage 4 lung cancer. So decided that if I'm ever going to kind of make everything right there, it's probably time to move home. And that's how I ended up in
Detroit. By you say making things right, you know, repairing your relationship or growing your relationship?
Yeah, yeah. That hadn't lived with my father since 5th or 6th grade. Probably never even spent a night at his home. He was always a part of my life, but not like, you know, he was a friend, mm-hmm. wasn't always a father necessarily. So I knew that it was terminal and I could stay on my plan in New York, working at firms, paying off my loans, or move back home. And I chose to move back home and took care of him and did some things like that.
And that led you to government?
Yeah, the interesting thing when I was going to move home, if I went to a private firm, I wouldn't have even been able to pay my monthly law school loans. But if I went into public service, Columbia would cover my loans while I was in public service. So that's what I started briefly. I had a stop at this chief legal counsel, the Secretary of State's office, but then went over and worked in the Attorney General's office.
And What other than that, you could pay off your loans, what about it appealed to you?
You know, it was both working in the Attorney General's office was such an amazing experience, like an eye-opening experience for me, because whatever that vision was as a 4th grader, 5th grader, of that you could do good in law, you could impact people's lives, I fundamentally got to see that while working in the Attorney General's office. I did everything from some youth in need of care cases, you know, abuse and neglect cases, to working on the legislative agenda, to some constitutional issues. And the great thing about working as an AG is so much of being a lawyer is looking backwards. I mean, what happened in this incident, you know, in litigation? In the Attorney General's office, you can also look forward. How can you meaningfully impact people's lives?
And are there particular cases that you worked on or projects you worked on that moved you, that stuck with you, that said, man, this is why I'm here?
Yeah, that's, you know, one case. So it was the Mountain States Legal Foundation, which was conservative group had sued to get rid of our stream access laws. And Montana has the best access laws in the country, meaning that anybody can, as long as they stay within the water marks, can access all the streams of our state. So, you know, you can't shut down people from using these. And to me, as somebody that also grew up outdoors, and like, this is one of the things that makes Montana unique. So I was in federal court, I'm 3 years out of law school, and saying, my name is Steve Bullock, I represent the people of Montana, the rivers and streams belong to all of us. Now, it's heady enough and to be able to say, I represent the people of Montana, which is pretty darn cool. But to then be able to take that case, and we won, I'm like, this attorney general job is the greatest job out there. So that's what really kind of got me thinking about that and on that path.
And you were so moved by the experience that you decided to run for the office. Like, you just joined the choir and you decided to run for choir master.
I was so moved by the experience that I decided when I was 32 or 33, like, this is the job I want. So I ran for it.
And got your ass kicked.
I got my ass kicked. I got ran against a guy who's also, I'd say, a good friend now. He's the Chief Justice of the Montana Supreme Court. But, yeah, I'm not sure that even my whole family voted for me.
Yeah. Well, I asked you when we were talking to the young people before, what did you learn from – you know, people always talk about what they've learned from winning.
Yeah.
But my experience has been that you can learn a lot from losing.
Yeah, and I've learned more from setbacks in life than the successes. And certainly at the time, I wasn't sure that I learned anything other than I don't think I ever want to run for office again. You know, I mean, some people might run because, oh, to get their name out there. But I ran because I thought I could do a good job with it. But I think I learned a bit about both people and about campaigning that still stuck with me, that, I mean, Montana is a 147,000 square mile state. And when I subsequently ran 8 years later, that the way you win is actually to get out and engage with people. And engage with people, not just, you know, identify Democrats, but to get out and to listen. And
you did take a break right in there after you lost. You went to Washington and practiced law there.
So I got done running for office. I lost. I still had about $100,000 in debt. I'm married. And so I decided to move to D.C., and I worked at a law firm and just taught as an adjunct legal writing at GW Law School. So got all my law school loans paid off.
Doing what kind of law there?
It was litigation. It was so like there was a case, a 6-week trial that started 3 days after 9/11, dealing with the construction of the Green Line, you know, the subway system as an example. Mm-hmm. So
the Green Line in Chicago?
No, in D.C.
Oh, in D.C.
Yeah.
Because your firm had a Chicago connection as well.
Steptoe Johnson started a Chicago office actually while I was there, but the main office was right on DuPont.
Yeah. I see. And what made you go back?
So during that time, and I think, you know, I was enjoying my work at the law firm and surrounded by good people, and I could have saw that path along there.
Probably getting paid pretty well for once in your life.
Getting paid a heck of a lot more than I do right now. But also, we'd had our first child. And during that time also, my wife's father got ill, and we knew that that's where we wanted to go. So once the law school loans were all paid off, moved back home and started that pinnacle of the legal establishment for a little while called the Bullock Law Firm. Uh-huh. So I went from like a 400-lawyer firm to being a sole practitioner.
Before, I want to ask you about that experience, but this whole discussion of the student loans, they were that what to do about those loans was kind of a defining thing in your life. So this, you know, you hear this all the time. I mean, I'm on a campus, but as you travel around the country, this is a huge issue for people.
No, this is real. I mean, I showed up at Columbia Law School with a credit card and a pen to sign student loan documents. When I got out of Columbia Law School, I could have gotten forbearance, even though I was getting paid pretty well, because still relative, my monthly student debt payment wasn't, was more than what the income structures were. And to this day, I'll never forget the day that we paid off our last student loan. And I think when we look at the opportunities for the next generation, just like the opportunities for me were limited in part, or at least defined in part by loans, that we got to be well aware of what we're doing with saddling kids with debt. Because even from that time, I graduated law school in 94. I mean, the cost of a college education, the cost of all higher education has spiked a heck of a lot faster than the cost of living has.
So you had the solo practice in Helena, and you got involved in a ballot measure, in Montana.
Yeah, so I was more or less out of the political system. I was being a lawyer, and
was it always in your head that you wanted to get back at some point?
After losing that first time, mm-hmm. I don't know if it was, but I don't know that was what I thought my path ought to be. But it was that ballot measure in part, too. So at the time, minimum wage was $4.15 in Montana. And in our legislature, it died on a very close vote to increase it. And one of the legislative leaders said something like, now I don't have to lay off people with disabilities. Not recognizing that the vast majority of folks on minimum wage are single-parent head a household, struggling to keep things together. It's not college students. It's not others. So formed this group called Raise Montana. And by mostly volunteer effort, we increased the minimum wage. And that's kind of what got me excited and engaged, saying that, you can impact this system and you can make a difference. So that was, I think, 2006. 2008 was coming up. And
What did you raise the minimum wage to?
At the time, we just raised it $1. So, but then we indexed it for inflation.
I see.
Yeah.
There's this is an ongoing debate within the Democratic Party about a couple of the issues we talked about college affordability and whether we should ask people to pay for college, about minimum wage and whether we should raise it to, say, $15 an hour. I'm sure you get asked these questions as you move around, and you seem passionate about these things. Are these viable answers?
Well, I think we have to, yes, in part they're viable answers. I look at—
Which part?
Since the recession until today, if we're in Arizona right now, state funding for higher education has decreased 50%. On average, it's decreased in real terms 17% across the country. My value has been, I'm pleased that Montana has the fourth lowest cost of college for tuition and fees, and we're one of four or five states that's actually been increasing our investments. So figuring out how to make college affordable is important. Figuring out how a third of the workforce now is making, I think, $12 an hour or less, 37 million people. And figuring out the ways to increase that, because that brings us all up, I think, are essential.
What about the notion that we should make college, just as we made high school a universal right, that we should make college or some corresponding technical training a universal right in the 21st century?
Well, there's a lot more that we could be doing, in as much as, we're about to the point, in the early 70s, only a third of the workforce needed something past high school. By 2020, it's two-thirds. Not everybody's going to go to college, first of all.
Right.
And recognizing the professionally recognized certificates and apprenticeship programs, and there are ways to move this along where we ought to do so. I think that making it affordable is essential. Making it free, I think we'd have to figure out both the dollar, the way to fund this, and also that there was a part of me having to work through college, pay part of the bill, that made it so it is, I so appreciated what I was getting along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's what's been changing, is the increasing, just inflating costs of college. We've got to figure out ways to make it more affordable and accessible. And that, I mean, the transition plan may be well for, and some states are looking at this, is putting in $2 for our two-year institutions, last dollar in, meaning that after Pell Grants and everything else, that the state would cover that.
Mm-hmm.
But the overall goal of saying that college has got to be accessible and affordable for everybody that so chooses.
I
think it's a capstone.
But it strikes me that in our times, given the importance of education or training for the jobs that are emerging in this new economy, if you price people out of it, then you're really going to exacerbate this problem we already have of income inequality. You're going to be destined to live in the class in which you're born.
I think that's true. I think also, though, Democrats sometimes make this mistake that everybody's got to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, like, we've pushed, well, I've been governor, a lot on work-based learning and apprenticeships, making our two-year colleges not even about an associate's degree, but about a professionally recognized certificate, realizing that there are 1,000 different apprentice jobs. It's not just welding, though welding's so important, and figuring out how we can partner to actually get people the skills that they need. And that doesn't necessarily mean all the time a degree.
You ran for attorney general. You finally won the job that you wanted.
Three-way primary. I wasn't supposed to win, but I ran for attorney general. Yeah.
And you got elected by a small margin in the general. And there, one of the things that you grapple with was another major challenge confronting our country, which is the issue of drug addiction. Tell me about that and what the whole...
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because, having worked in the AG's office 8 years prior, like, I knew the Division of Criminal Investigation folks. I knew the drug cops and others. And more of them, when I was thinking about running, were saying, the issues aren't just meth anymore. It's now prescription drugs. And then when we looked at it, the amount of deaths occurring because of prescription drugs and because of fentanyl was overwhelming everything else we had. So I started running on, that was part of my campaign, to say we have to address what was, I called, the invisible epidemic. And it was amazing, wherever I went, then somebody would come up with a personal story of
it is an epidemic.
Yeah.
That's just cut through our country, and particularly in rural areas.
Yeah.
And it's a siege.
Yeah, it's a public health issue. But we approached it then. I mean, it's interesting because if you look at our highest fatality rates for prescription drug abuse were probably 2009 or 2010, and we've actually decreased it where all the other states. Yeah, I think we took a multifaceted approach. First of all, we educated people, saying that prescription drugs, they have a very important role. You know, they can also kill people. So the education piece, that just because it comes from a doctor, it's not safe. We tried to remove the supply.
You also established this electronic drug registry to make it harder to get these pain
The pills. Registry so that the pill, you'd have essentially pill seekers going from doctor to doctor to doctor. Then there was a registry that showed where, you know, if someone was just pill seeking as opposed to legitimately in need, then we could shut that down. We did a lot of prescription drug takebacks. I'll never forget one of the first, because people hang on to the drugs. There were break-ins into houses just to get at your medicine cabinet. A 1952 glass pill bottle somebody turned in and said, I didn't know what else to do with it. So we worked on law enforcement, education, getting rid of supply, and working on treatment issues as well.
And you also... You were in the Attorney General's office when we were just coming out of this mortgage crisis, but you probably were touched by that as well.
We were, and was part of the multi-state efforts on the mortgage. And then once we reached a settlement, figuring out how to try to, and the flood was in Montana just like everywhere else, how to get people to be able to stay in their homes. And talk about moments of crises that you saw all over the country in places like Montana were equally impacted.
What made you, did you know from the time you ran for attorney general that you'd turn around and run for governor?
Not at all. I mean, I'd run for office to become attorney general, not necessarily to ever run for governor. And had, in addition like that work, we did some great work as attorney general on corporate money and politics, and was so excited about that job. And it was interesting because, well, then my predecessor was termed out, and I had a lot of people saying, oh, you have to run for governor, yell it to us. And I was at first like, no, I wasn't supposed to win for attorney general. I don't owe it to anybody to run for something else. And I made a lot of lists saying, you know, the pros and cons of giving up a job that I love, and I think it could have got reelected, for one that I might not get elected to, and I don't know if I'd love. And ultimately, I kind of reached the conclusion that Montana was a gift for me growing up, and it truly was, from the schools to the outdoors. And now as a father with kids, I want to keep it a gift for them. And there were more and more sort of the efforts to both from privatizing schools and sort of this is as the anti-government forces were getting greater and greater that I thought, okay, maybe I need to do this.
How old are your kids?
I now have a 16-year-old daughter named Caroline, a 14-year-old daughter named Alex or Alexandria, then a son who turns 12 on October 2nd named Cameron.
How, you know, we rarely talk about this, but how have they fared through your political career? They've grown up with you in public life. And, you know, having worked with people in politics for a long time, I think the sacrifice associated with that is not always well understood.
Yeah, you know, it had been 40 years in Montana since kids, the age of the kids that my wife Lisa and I have, are living in the governor's residence. So it certainly shaped how I approached many things. On the one hand, each of my children got to have dinner at the White House and meet President and Mrs. Obama. And my oldest daughter, Caroline, went to the inauguration and rode a horse down Constitution Avenue. So have had incredible experiences. Yeah. But it's not without a share of challenge as well, because, you know, living in the bubble of being the governor's kid. And,
you know, when I was a reporter, there was a congressman, Paul Simon, in Illinois, who wanted to run for the U.S. Senate, and he wanted me to go to work for him. And we had three children, one of whom was sick, and my wife was very reluctant. And I said, and he said, well, let Gene, his wife, and I come down and talk to you about it. And my wife said, well, what's it like when you're in politics for the kids? And Gene said, well, it's a mixed thing, you know. On the one hand, Martin, that's their son, got to sit between Walter Mondale and George McGovern at a dinner. And she said, on the other hand, his father wasn't around much when he was a kid. Yeah. And they left, and my wife closed the door, Susan, and she closed the door, and she said, that doesn't sound like
absolutely not.
Doesn't sound like a very good trade-off. So
I had a rule when I became attorney general that as long as I was in town, I'd go home at 6 o'clock, we'd have dinner as a family, I'd stay there until my kids were asleep, and then if I had to go back to work or do things – certainly, and that's as long as I was in town. I still have that same rule, but usually I get home at 6 o'clock and
they don't want to see you.
Well, our daughter's at volleyball practice, the son's playing football, and it's like, I'm the only one home.
Well, it's a good excuse to get out of work anyway. So the governorship, this issue of money in politics, this has been a big issue of yours that you've fought from the beginning. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, and the history of Montana was a history of corporate control. We had these copper kings, they were called. I mean, Clark County, Nevada is named after William Clark, who was one of the copper kings. And they literally bought, around the turn of the century, all of the offices that we had. I mean, William Clark bought a U.S. Senate seat and was, you know, went out there and he was in a committee and he said, there's so much money in politics now that people don't even vote. So Montanans finally took back their state, passing the Corrupt Practices Act of 1912, and it said that corporations couldn't spend or contribute in our elections. As a result, elections in Montana always low contribution limits, and elections were about talking to people. It wasn't how much money you raised, it's how many doors you knocked. Citizens United comes up. I'm Attorney General. We wrote the amicus brief that the majority of states actually joined on, the friend of the court brief, including Republican states, saying that if you're going to screw with our campaign finance system, recognize the vast majority of elections actually happen at the state and local level, including our judges. And it doesn't take a copper king or a Koch brother to buy,
you can buy judges cheaply.
Yep. So we lost that. And then Montana, meaning that Citizens United decision came down, and I was sued on the Corrupt Practices Act of 1912. Every other state said, game over. We actually build a factual record. Citizens United had no factual record. And we had Republican testimony even on the corrupting influence of even the threat of independent expenditures. We won at our state Supreme Court level. It was the first case after Citizens United to go all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And on a 5-4 decision, 100 years of Montana history was summarily disposed, with the dissent saying, even our experience since Citizens United demonstrates that we need to revisit this issue.
You've got two competitive elections right now, one for the Senate and one for the House. And I imagine that a great deal of money is being spent on your television stations are probably doing well in this. What is the impact of all of this?
I mean, it is disastrous from my perspective. Now, at the state level, even with a legislature that's two-thirds Republican, got passed a bill that said if you're a dark money group, so if you're a group that doesn't report your contributors, if you're going to spend in our elections in the last 90 days, you have to disclose those donors. So even when I was up in 2016, the last mailing against me by the Koch brothers or Americans for Prosperity was 91 days out. So it can be done at least to add transparency and at the state level. But I think what we're seeing more and more, you know, being out on your campus today and hoping that these college students understand that there's one day every 2 years that we're all equal, and that's election day, and our vote is our voice. And I've seen elections close enough, as I'm sure you have, that every vote matters. And I think, in part, all the money coming in
2016 nationally, where 80,000 votes over three states tipped the presidency. In 2000, when you were losing your race for attorney general, there was a presidential race that was decided by 5,737, I think, votes in Florida.
Yeah.
So,
And what we're seeing with all this outside money is, and the vast majority of it spent on negative ads as well, is that I think it adds to the polarization. It also adds to the disenfranchisement of folks saying, my participation doesn't even matter. This is all about money. And that's, I mean, I think it's a real threat to this experiment called representative democracy that's so important.
Though no indication that the court is likely to move off of that. With, you know, we may, as we speak, and I will talk about this in a second, there is this debate as to whether Judge Kavanaugh will ascend to the bench, but he's certainly not going to tip the court in favor of a rollback of Citizens United. There's nothing in his history that would suggest that.
No, I think that's right, and I think it's unfortunate. But then at least begin with the premise, and Citizens United said, well, we can do all this because with the advent of the internet and everything, at least there's complete transparency, meaning that people will know who's trying to influence elections. What we've seen since Citizens United, though, is the rise of not just super PACs and individuals, but dark money groups where we don't know who's writing the check. Right. And I think that's an area where, like in the state, not only did we pass that law, I did an executive order saying if someone's going to contract with the state of Montana,
they have to disclose whether they're donating to political
And we sued the administration, the current administration, the IRS, because they're now getting rid of the requirements of even getting the names of 501c4 donors to the Department of Treasury. Meaning that the courts, unfortunately, has conflated corporations with individuals and money with speech. We may not be able to change that until we have either a constitutional amendment or a different court, but we can make differences in adding sunshine and transparency. It's just but one area.
I'm going to come back to money because I want you to explain to me how a guy from Montana runs for president in this day and age, given the amount of money that's required. Not that I'm asking you to announce here.
Yeah, I don't.
But it must be something
that from anywhere.
Well, so if you're from California, it's a lot easier. If you're from New York, it's a lot easier. If you're from one of the money centers, it's a lot easier than it is. But we'll get back to that. Talk to me about being a Democratic governor in a state. Donald Trump carried your state by 20 points. You expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act and supported the Affordable Care Act. I assume you have an exchange as well?
No, we don't.
You're in the federal exchange.
We use federal exchange.
And you officiated over a same-sex marriage. There are many ways in which you are in that solidly progressive category. You've also your position has evolved on guns. Recently, but tell me how you navigate that path. That how do you survive in a very polarized time as a blue governor in a red state?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I try not to begin with the premise that, well, it's a very polarized time. People still expect government to work. I mean, when we mentioned how young my kids were, my first day of the state, I talked about the different noises of laughter that will be emanating from the governor's house. And let's actually, as legislators and as governor, let's act like our kids are watching and learning from our words and deeds, because they do. So I've tried to elevate the discussion overall in that way. I've said to people, I will meet you as legislators. I'll meet you at least part way if we can actually focus on what's good. Now, I still fundamentally believe in this polarized time that most people's lives are too busy to worry about politics. So in campaigning, I go to places that it's not just where there's a lot of Democrats in sight. I show up, I listen. I do the same in governing, for sure. I mean, we got Medicaid expansion through, in part I'll never forget, went to a town called Shoto, Montana. 1,700 people, and everybody in town knew I was going to be there because Americans for Prosperity had mailed the pictures of me and Barack Obama. But when the hospital administrator was the first to speak and said, 40% of the people that walk through these doors don't have health care. And a county commissioner said, we lose this hospital. We lose this community. I mean, by listening and letting them speak, we've been able to get things done.
I presume when you ran for re-election, you released a statement. You're running against Greg Gianforte, who's now the congressman there, and he was attacking you on guns. And you released a statement saying Steve Bullock supports Montana's current laws when it comes to gun rights. He opposes universal background checks. He has expanded gun rights as governor, and he'll always stand up for the Second Amendment. That seems like a concession to the realities of your state.
Well, I mean, I was attorney general when the Heller decision came up, and I brought the state into it, and the Second Amendment is an individual right. And I have time and time again tried to say, where are common sense gun measures? I've signed some things. I've vetoed a bunch of things as well. I think that there's more that we need to be doing, though.
Yeah. I mean, you've changed your position on universal background checks.
Yeah.
You've changed your position on the assault weapons ban. Why did you change your position? Was that something that you've done in order to make yourself more acceptable to a broader Democratic electorate?
Or? No. You know, I had and we're recording this, I guess, like 3 or 4 days before the one-year anniversary of the Vegas shooting.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to speak at the March for Our Lives in Helena, Montana, and I'm like, no, I don't want to. But instead, I went with my two daughters, and I listened to these kids. I can't believe my son started middle school this year. I think it's by the end of the first week, he's telling me about the lockdown drills, and he's already learned the safest places in the school. I had challenges growing up. It wasn't challenges like this. So I think we've hit a tipping point where we've got to be doing more. And we can do more in ways that most firearm owners that I know, all firearm owners that I know, myself included, we don't want these guns in the wrong hands. We don't want them used for the wrong purposes. So there's got to be, though, ways that we can, if we start looking at this public health issue more than just as an issue that completely divides the country, I think we can make progress.
Why did Donald Trump do so well in your state, and why did Democrats lose in 2016?
Well, okay, to step back, President Obama lost Montana in 2008 by 2 points.
Mm-hmm.
And he had also showed up there. And he was present there quite a bit and had a real presence.
I think we were there the night before he flew into Denver for the convention. I remember because we were still trying to figure out what he should say through the convention speech. So we had a late night meeting, I think in Butte, where we worked that through.
Yeah. But so I think in part to get to a lot of folks aren't feeling like this economy is working for them, right? When I say today only about half of 30-year-olds are doing better than their parents were at age 30. When I was growing up, it was 90% of 30-year-olds were doing better. So the economy's broken, and they look to the political system, and they don't see it working. So I think that a lot of voters, and that's just not in Montana, said, well, D.C.'s not working. We need somebody that says, I will fight for you. And they believe that they would fight for them.
And how much is this a cultural phenomenon? You talk about people feeling alienated economically. What about culturally?
I don't.
You know, because the impression is that there's a sort of red state, blue state, rural, urban divide.
But if we're not, if Democrats aren't even talking to people in the rural areas, if we're not giving them a reason to vote for us, if we're not turning around and saying, you know what, I recognize you're not climbing the economic ladder. Here are things that can be done. I mean, I think it goes back more than cultural divides. It is sort of the economic divides right now. And if someone in rural Ohio doesn't think that the Democrats care about them or speaking to them, well, then they're going to go somewhere else.
I mentioned earlier this battle over the Supreme Court. We may know the outcome of it before this podcast is aired, but what do you make of this? You used to prosecute cases or oversee the prosecution of cases. I'm sure sexual assault was one of them. I know you were busy today when the hearing was going on, but it looks like there's going to be a vote, and it's going to be some hard politics, and it's going to, you know, you minimize the polarization of the country, but this can be a pretty polarizing vote, isn't it?
Well, I mean, first, from my perspective, there shouldn't be a vote right now. I mean, when a woman comes out with a credible claim and a claim that she was sexually assaulted, that should be investigated. So I think it will be polarizing if folks don't take a pause on it, if the Republicans don't say, listen, let's actually do an investigation as we should. We're talking about a lifetime appointment here. So I would always love to see ways where we're bringing down the polarization. But I don't, beyond partisanship, I mean, if I am a Democrat or a Republican out in any place other than Washington, D.C., you'd like to think that folks would say, you know what? This is a very important vote. We should at least get all the facts.
But really what's happened is that it has become like everything becomes polarized by tribe and party. And the argument that's being made for Judge Kavanaugh is he's been victimized by Democrats who surfaced this charge late. He vehemently denies them. You're right. There hasn't been a...
So do an investigation. Figure it out, right? I mean, as opposed to talking over one another or saying I've been victimized, just do an investigation. That's what we've done in the past.
If it doesn't happen, what do you think the political impact of that is? And what is the impact on the country?
Yeah. I never suggest like I'm a pundit and no. From that perspective, but I think that the impact on the country when we're doing not only a lifetime appointment, but a woman or women that have come up to sacrifice themselves and we're not even doing an investigation. I mean, maybe it does make us more polarized. That's unfortunate. I think this will be one where people look back and say, we probably should have.
Do you think it's likely to galvanize women if the nomination goes forward?
I would hope so. I mean, I would certainly hope that more and more women, but not just women too.
Let me ask
men.
You.
Men,
no,
too
of course.
Should be saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. But let me ask you, you have a Senator John Tester. He's already drawn the attention of the president who's been there and beaten up on him. And probably will, I don't know, is he coming back?
You know, he's been back two times. I think the vice president's coming out again next week, so I wouldn't be surprised.
And one of the things when this nomination was made that people said was, well, these red state senators in states that Trump won are really in the crosshairs here and run a great risk if they oppose the nomination. Do you think that's changed now because of what's happened with Christine Blasey Ford?
Yeah, I think it could well. And I also think some Republican senators are saying, well, wait a minute, we owe our constituents a lot better than what this process has been. So I do hope that that's the case.
And so you don't think he's under the same pressure that he might have been to support the nomination?
Well, I think that, you know, Senator Tester's, like, they haven't even given him a meeting with Judge Kavanaugh yet. And I think Senator Tester's the kind of guy that, I mean, he will listen carefully and make a decision. But what I've seen in the past with Senator Tester is that he tries to figure out what's actually going to be best for the country and for Montana.
What about you? You've been traveling quite a bit. You're here in Chicago, but you've also been in other outposts like Iowa, New Hampshire. That, to a political guy, that's like, my ears get trained when I hear that. And it's no secret. You were at the Iowa State Fair, I think. Yeah. Did you go by the butter sculptures and eat fried Twinkies and stuff.
I was on the soapbox talking about the corrupting influence of money in politics.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
How seriously are you considering running for president?
I think that
– I know, and let's just stipulate, because just in the interest of time, that there's an intervening election that's important. Yeah. I'm sure you're campaigning for candidates, but that election's hard on us, and then you're going to have to make a decision.
Yeah, I think that I have – look, I think I'm the only Democrat in the country to get reelected in a state where Trump won. I've been able to get progressive things done and show that government can function. So I think that I have something to offer to the conversation. And as what we're stipulating, in some ways, then I've been out campaigning to try to get more governors and a few other congressional folks. But I've also been listening, not just in Iowa, but also places like Arkansas, and was in Ohio for Rich Cordray yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, at least, that's as far as it goes. I don't know what I'll do. But I think I have the one thing that I don't want to do is wake up the day after the next election and say we're in the exact same position. So if I have something to offer that conversation, then it's worth.
How do you overcome the fact that you're from a very small state? It's an 88% white state. It's your state budget, I think, is what, $6 billion or something like that. It's a small state. It's not a political base of any kind. And as we said earlier, money has become so difficult in politics. How do you marshal a campaign starting from that place?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I got to believe that it's not just about money. I mean, if that was the case, even on the Republican side, Trump wouldn't have become president. And I have to
believe. He had celebrity. I mean, you're not taking over the Celebrity Apprentice anytime soon, are you?
So. I don't think we'll count on that, David. I also think that, I'm hoping that there'll be a lot of people looking at it in 2020. I'm a governor. Governors actually have to govern, have to get things done. You know, we've seen, Senator Obama was in his first term before that. I think the last senator to get elected
JFK.
Was JFK then.
Yeah.
And
then Harding before that, I think.
Yeah. Come from place, the West, which I think that has something to add to the conversation. But I don't, at the end of the day, first, I got to figure out, do I have something to offer? And
you just went through a few reasons that would suggest to me that you think you do.
I think I have something to offer the conversation for mm-hmm. sure. I mean, I think that we as a party need to make sure that we can be competitive in places from Michigan to Wisconsin to Ohio to Pennsylvania, in addition to being competitive on the coast.
Were you frustrated with the national campaign in 2016?
I was pretty busy with my own. I didn't.
Although that you had a vested interest in how well the Democratic ticket would do.
Yeah, yeah.
When you heard Hillary Clinton, not to pound on her here, but when she said the deplorable thing and so on, did that impact adversely on you? And on Democrats generally, in areas like yours?
I think that at its core is that if there's a whole lot of people both in our country, geographically, demographically, and others that say that the Democratic Party isn't the party that cares about whether I have a decent job or good schools or a roof over my head, then we're in a lot of trouble.
You think the party's too focused on urban areas?
Not necessarily. Meaning that, and we talked about a little bit outside. Like, mm-hmm. I fundamentally believe wherever you live, most people want the same things. They want your safe community, a roof over your head, a decent job, clean air and clean water. The values, those are values that Democrats have traditionally been fighting for each step of the way. So the focus of not even showing up or having a presence in areas says a lot to people. The focus on the way that we speak and say, you know, Bill Clinton said, I feel your pain, right? That not everybody's doing better along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And to have meaningful solutions for these issues.
You you would be viewed as a in the pantheon of potential candidates as a more moderate candidate, more of a centrist Democrat. You're comfortable with that label?
You know, I think that there, like, I'm not sure that everybody's already trying to slice and dice something a ways, kind of pit us against them or sort of these mentalities. I'm not sure that I buy any of that. Like, I've been able to do progressive things in Montana, but I've been able to get things done, and I've been able to bridge some of the divides that we're seeing in other parts of the country.
You're not going to buy into it. I can see I'm not going to go down this rat hole. So anyway, what's your timetable for making a decision?
I don't honestly have any timetable.
When do you think you have to make a decision by? You've got smart political people around that you talk to. What are they telling you?
You know, there hasn't been any, like, I imagine immediately after the elections, some people are going to jump in and say, I'm running for president.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, some already have.
Yeah.
That won't be me.
Mm-hmm. But at some point, your decision is made for you if you don't step forward.
Yeah, I think that's probably true as well.
Okay. Governor Steve Bullock, it's great to be with you. Thank you for coming to the Institute of Politics, and good luck.
Thanks, David.
In the coming months and years.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. For more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.